Back on the program is Professor Jonathan Nitzan. Professor Nitzan, Jonathan, welcome.
Yes, good evening.
Good to talk to you again, and Happy New Year to you.
Same to you.
Jonathan, the latest reason we have you on the program, first of course, we talked last time about your book, The Global Political Economy of Israel, but this time around, you've made a prediction for 2003. You have the world moving into a state of global stagflation. And in order for us to understand what that prediction means, you're going to have to back us up and help us understand what global stagflation means.
First, stagflation. Stagflation is a combination of two words, stagnation and inflation. It means essentially a situation when there is high unemployment and little or no growth, but this comes together with rising prices. Why this special name? Economists gave this phenomenon a name in the 1970s because they thought this is a strange beast. They thought that inflation should occur only when the economy is booming rather than when it stagnates.
Right.
So when prices are rising during a slump, this seems like an anomaly. My own personal view is that this is to some extent a cover-up. I don't think that stagflation is an exception. In fact, I think it is the rule. In most cases, inflation occurs during a crisis, and it is actually pretty rare to have a prolonged period of inflationary boom. In other words, inflation together with growth.
Well, it's interesting because in this country, of course, David Dodge and the rest of his crew at the Bank of Canada express an ongoing, highly tuned concern to fears of inflation in the Canadian economy. So we are, therefore, as taxpayers, led to believe that inflation is connected to prosperous times. The Canadian economy, unlike our neighbors to the south, has been doing quite well in the past year, and thus we expect concerns for inflation out of a prosperous year. And yet you're saying that's not usually the case.
No, it's not. The central banks always are concerned for inflation. This is their business. But their concern for inflation is based on a certain theory that expresses the causes of inflation, and they believe all around the world that inflation is caused by economic growth. Historically, I think that this belief is misguided. If you look at periods which are very long, dating back maybe to the 13th century. Inflations, long periods of inflation usually were periods of massive crisis.
Right.
So I think economists have a very, very short memory, and they are also sometimes stuck in their short memory, even going back only to the 1970s or the 1980s, where the highest inflation in the post-war period was recorded, and this was a period of massive stagnation worldwide. So there is certainly here an element, in my opinion, of delusion.
But you could understand, though, why many Canadians make incorrect assumptions when they hear concerns or even discussion of inflation because of the posture of the Bank of Canada and the lack of real inflation in our economy. We, I think, connect inflation with prosperous times and a need for vigilance.
Well, I can understand that people are misguided, but if you think about the period of the 1990s, this was a period of relatively high growth mm-hmm. around the world, but if you look at what happened to inflation, it was falling systematically.
Yes.
So much so that now people are talking about a fear of deflation. So it actually goes contrary to the common sense of economists. It's the opposite phenomenon that has taken place.
Now, but you're coupling the word stagflation, Jonathan, with global in 2003. You see the world succumbing to this stagflation phenomenon. Why?
Well, before I answer, let me just say that, again, I'm not really in the business of predictions. I'm saying this is likely, and the reason I'm saying it is likely because I think the process of growth and disinflation of the 1990s has led to a situation that there is, in fact, massive overcapacity in the world today. There are a lot of factories that are lying idle or are producing below capacity. There is a lot of unemployment, either disguised unemployment or open unemployment. So there is a real threat of global deflation. My argument is that many groups, dominant groups, dominant corporations, and also the administration in the United States are interested in preventing that from happening. And I think that looking at what happens in the Middle East with the plans to invade Iraq, this is how they are planning, in my opinion, of making it happen. In other words, preventing deflation by creating inflation through conflict in the Middle East.
Well, now, there you've already tuned our minds to looking to historical precedents in this conversation already, Jonathan, in your usual adept fashion. So we have plenty of 20th century historical anecdotal evidence to support what appears to be the Bush theory here, that there's nothing like a good old-fashioned shooting war to stimulate the economy. Is the Bush policy towards Iraq that simplistically motivated, do you think?
Frankly, I disagree that war actually stimulates the economy. If the Bush administration is focused on something, it is focused for and foremost on profitability, and profitability is not always correlated with a booming economy. You can have a situation, for example, in the 1970s and 80s, in which the economy was stagnating, in which there was inflation, in other words, there was stagflation.
Mm-hmm.
And leading groups that were connected at that time to the Reagan administration, or the Republican administration and then the Reagan administration, did wonderfully well. These are the oil companies, these are the armament companies, the leading banks. They have done tremendously well during that period. It's not that everybody was doing well, but the people who had impact on the administration have done well. So I don't think that the situation now is profoundly different. In other words, there are many of us who are going to probably see the short end of the stick if there is stagflation developing, but I don't think that I, for example, have an impact on the Bush administration as do the oil companies, for instance.
Right. Okay. But, you know, the American economy is showing certainly any number of symptoms of a stagnant situation.
Mm-hmm.
with manufacturing spending down, with job creation way down,
mm-hmm.
with unemployment correspondingly up. And again, these are all clues that economists look to when trying to take a look at what's likely to be next. And what's likely from where I'm sitting, Jonathan, and I don't imagine your perspective in Montreal is that much different, is a war of some kind with Iraq. To the benefit of whom?
Well, that's precisely the question that I would ask if you didn't ask me, but you did. So I think that if we ask this question, who is going to benefit from this war, I think that most broadly, large corporations are going to be better off from this war than without the war for two reasons. First, the war, to the extent that it triggers higher oil prices and pushes overall inflation up, is going to diffuse the enormous threat that now exists in the mind of many executives and big investors of deflation. So that's the first reason why they would support this war, and actually this is what you see in the business press.
Okay.
The second reason is that historically, if you examine the past 50 years of experience in the United States, for example, inflation has always redistributed income from wages to profits. So there is a distributional benefit for big corporations to have from inflation. So this is the kind of the outer circle that is going to benefit from a war in the Gulf, provided this war is actually going to ignite some measure of inflation and prevent deflation. Now, much closer to the Bush administration, we have a circle of oil companies and armament companies who are going to be the really big winners of such a conflict. Again, if you look at the past quarter century, the profits of the oil companies, not only in the United States but globally, have been correlated almost entirely with the price of oil, not with the production of oil. In other words, the level of production grows by about 6% a year overall in the world, production of oil. But
okay,
the price of oil fluctuates by hundreds and sometimes by thousands of percent. So it is the changes in the price of oil that determine profitability, and the profits of the oil companies have plummeted from roughly 22% of global profits. In other words, the oil companies made almost a quarter of all world profits in the 1980s, and they have plummeted to about 3% recently. And since then, they have backed up quite significantly because of the rise in the price of oil. So as far as they're concerned, if I were sitting in New York in the headquarters of some of these firms, I would know that the thing that is going to make my profit go up is not taking over the production of crude oil in Iraq, but raising the price of oil. So they have a clear interest in a higher price of oil. I do not know to what extent they're actually behind the maneuvers, but certainly the connections between oil and armament interest in the Bush administration are well known, so this speculation does not seem to me very far-fetched.
Jonathan, I need to take a quick station break. Please stand by in Montreal, if you will. Our guest is from the Department of Political Science at York University in Toronto, Professor Jonathan Nitzan, and we'll be right back here on the Chorus Radio Network. We're back. Our guest is Jonathan Nitzan, professor of political economics at York University in Toronto, who's talking about what he thinks might happen to the world economy in 2003, a phenomenon called global stagflation. Now, Jonathan, before the break, you were talking to us about those who might benefit the most from what appears to be a looming conflict, a war of some description in Iraq, probably about 6 weeks away by my barometer. How does that, and you said the oil, the armament sector and the energy sector, specifically the oil companies, are going to be among the biggest beneficiaries. A very large segment of this program's audience, Jonathan, is in the province of Alberta, where the oil patch happens to be as well. So talk to us a little bit about how this might impact not only on Canadian oil companies, but say the people of Alberta as their lot in life might improve or slide somewhat based on this prediction of global stagflation.
Yes. Like in every social process of this type of dimension, there are all a lot of losers that actually are hurt for no fault of theirs, and there are also a lot of people who win without doing anything. And I think that the case of a province like Alberta is an example of perhaps a bystander that actually end up gaining from the process. For example, the government of Alberta is going to enjoy higher royalties if the price of oil is going up.
Sure, yeah.
People who work in the oil patch, workers, will possibly enjoy higher wages if they are able to wrestle them out from the oil companies. The oil companies are not necessarily going to give them to them unless they struggle for it, but there will be more money to spend. So there will be groups who will benefit from this war, although they might have really no impact on the war itself. There will be probably an increase, if this process actually ends up unfolding, there will be an increase in all sorts of raw materials. We already saw this year an increase of something between 20 and 60% in the prices of different raw materials. So producers of raw materials, not only oil, but other commodities, could end up gaining from this process. But of course, there will be many who will, in Canada, who will lose from this process because they have no control of such commodities.
Okay. Now, does this, we've been talking about Canada, the United States. I assume by extension we're talking about the European Union and other Western democracies, capitalist systems, and so on. But you're talking about global stagflation.
Right.
So does this extend beyond the countries, the G8 and so on, into underdeveloped countries? And how will it impact there, if indeed it does, Jonathan?
Two points to be made. First of all, many of these developing countries already actually experiencing sometimes severe stagflation. So you have severe stagflation taking place in a country like Argentina now, or severe stagflation taking place in a country like Israel. But if they will actually develop a global stagflation, the impact is going to be probably much more serious than what we see now, for a very simple reason. And the reason is that the debt load of developing countries now is as high as it was during, and probably even higher than during the infamous debt crisis of the 1980s. Developing countries now spend roughly 25% of all their exports on just servicing their debt, in other words, repaying their loans and paying interest payments. Now, this is comparable to the 1980s, but in the 1980s, interest rates were already 20%. In other words, the debt burden was so high, partly because of very high interest rates. Interest rates now are about 3%. If there is inflation, and interest rates will shoot up, you can imagine that the debt burden is going to rise beyond what it is now, and it is already at record levels. So the consequences for developing countries, particularly those that have high debt loads, is going to be phenomenally disastrous.
Oh, now, we're not a developing country in the context that you've just been talking about, Jonathan, but in Canada, we have a huge debt load. And therefore, I think we're vulnerable, more vulnerable than we ought to be to global variations and so on. Talk to us about Canada's debt load, and if this phenomenon goes forward as you think it likely to, what does that do to our exposure, our vulnerability?
There are many ways of answering this question. In fact, it looks like a benign question, but it's pretty difficult and complicated to answer. Let me try to kind of point to some simple arguments that can be made. There's a big difference between the Western countries and the less developed countries in that the debt of developing countries is mostly to the Western countries, whereas the debt of most developed countries is to themselves. So to the extent that this debt creates a problem, it creates a redistribution usually within the Western society. So people who own government debt or private debt basically earn higher interest payments.
Mm-hmm.
Those who owe it are in deeper problem, but essentially it's redistribution within these societies. So the danger exists of greater social inequality, etc., but it is not as big as having a debt to elements outside of your society. But having said that, there is also a question of vulnerability because much like in the developing countries, the Western countries have accumulated over the past 50 years a huge debt load.
Yes.
The debt load in 1960 in the Western countries was roughly 40% of GDP. It is now 140% of GDP. So certainly a process of stagflation is going to create a serious problem. I just might want to add to that that the process of deflation, the opposite of stagflation, is going to be much worse. So the scenario that we are facing is potentially sort of a bad situation and a worse situation.
So it's the lesser of two evils, almost.
In a way, I suppose it is, yeah.
All right, Jonathan, stand by, if you would, please. Need to take a final station break, and then we'll get right back to our guest, Professor Jonathan Nitzan from York University, after this quick timeout across the Chorus Radio Network. And we're back. Final segment with Professor Jonathan Nitzan from the Department of Political Science at Toronto's York University. Professor Nitzan joining us from Montreal tonight. Jonathan, stagflation, stagnant economy, serious inflation problems, a dangerous combination. What and you've described how it might affect us and certainly the people in America and so on, but how would, if this prediction is as likely as you seem to think it is, how is it going to affect countries like Russia, which is just kind of getting into the groove in terms of a capitalist society and the market economy? It's been a huge turnaround mentally as well as physically for the Russians. And how about China? They're not anywhere near being capitalist yet, but they're kind of toying around with it. What effect would it have on those two major players on the world scene?
I'm glad you asked me this question. I think that Russia and China are similar in ways that you have described, but they're also different with respect to the impact stagflation is going to have on them. For one, Russia is a net producer of oil, whereas China is a net consumer of oil.
Okay.
So as far as higher oil prices are concerned, certainly China is going to suffer from it on that count, I think, much more. And we have the experience of the 1970s and 80s. In Japan, for example, Japan took a huge hit when the oil crisis of that period arrived because it was so dependent on energy. And I think that China might be in a similar situation now because it is so energy hungry. I think that both of these societies do not have the social safety net that has developed in the West, although it has been undermined tremendously over the past 10 years since the end of communism, it still is significantly better than what you see in these countries. So any increase in unemployment in these countries, any increase in the inequality of income distribution is going to throw out a lot of people into the streets. And in China, when you talk about a lot of people, you talk about many, many, many millions of people without a safety net. So there is a question of social stability in these countries, not to speak about the hardship of the individuals that are involved, that is of humongous proportions. And I don't think that these societies are particularly well equipped to handle such major changes that emanate from regions that they are far away from, but nonetheless affect them very immediately and directly.
A lot of this conversation, in fact, almost all of it, has been predicated upon, Jonathan, the United States and some allies going to war against Iraq, which seems about 99.9% likely. In the unlikely event that such a conflict does not occur, what does that do to your thoughts about global stagflation?
Short answer is probably it won't happen, and probably there will be a very serious chance of deflation developing. So that would be my hunch. This is probably one of the most effective ways of turning the tide from deflation to inflation. I cannot think of any other significant trigger to move towards inflation in a world that is so awash with excess capacity.
So the governments of Britain and America and so on, recognizing the requirements of the corporate sectors in these countries with respect to profitability and so on, are going to go forward because there's no alternative, really.
Well, I'm not sure that this is the only reason they go to war. I don't know that the George Bush and the people around him think only about that. They have other reasons that are, in my humble opinion, imperialistic reasons. But they nevertheless receive support from the business community, which supports them financially and ideologically. So
yes,
they feel that they have all the backing they need.
Okay. Now, what about the average citizen? There is, in this country particularly, I would think the majority of Canadians are deeply suspicious as to whether we ought to commit any manpower to the situation, and will, of course, only if the United States or the United Nations indicates that this is an appropriate measure. Are Canadians and some Americans quite right to be as deeply suspicious as we are?
I think that more of us should be deeply suspicious, and more of us should be utterly opposed to this type of kind of gun diplomacy. It's completely unacceptable in my view.
All right. Jonathan, we're almost out of time, and I just want to thank you for yours on a Saturday night. It's always a pleasure to have you on the program, and you've certainly given us an awful lot of food for thought. It's going to take a while maybe to sort out all of the facts, but an excellent presentation, and thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Jonathan Nitzan, professor of political economics at Toronto's York University. Professor Nitzan, for some reason, teaches in Toronto and lives in Montreal. Interesting commute. I wouldn't want to have it. It's almost like being a member of Parliament. When we come back after the break, we're going to turn our attention to another Canadian pressing matter, the matter of success in small-market NHL hockey towns like Ottawa for openers. Stay with us. We're back after the news.